Greetings, you beautiful humans. This is your friendly neighborhood podcast host, play-by-play man, and color analyst for life, Glenn Klein, in a beautiful day in Tampa Bay, kind of, sort of, for a throwback Thursday, April 11th, 2019, the only 4-11-2-0-19 in the history of humanity. Let us continue to choose on purpose, with a purpose, to give a great throwback. Well, I did hesitate to say it was a beautiful day in Tampa Bay because last night my Tampa Bay Lightning took it on the chin in game one of the quarterfinals of the Stanley Cup playoffs here at Amalie Arena against the Columbus Blue Jays, the Blue Jackets, with their former coach, John Tortorella, behind the bench for Columbus. The Lightning were up 3-0 after the first period and then did not show up for the second and third. And you got to give it to Columbus. You got to give it to the BJs. They just played hard, came back, won the game 4-3. Game two, Friday night, here in Channelside at Amalie Arena. Beautiful humans, the first step in recovery is realizing, acknowledging you have a problem. And I have a problem. I admit on the interweb that I am emotionally affected, win or lose, by the outcomes of the Tampa Bay Lightning games, especially during the Stanley Cup playoffs. So it's been a bit of a bummer here in the Hitting Home Media Group studios. But I shall survive, as the Grateful Dead sang so beautifully. Yeah, it's I got fired from the radio station in Racine, Wisconsin, because of the Lightning. Kind of, sort of. it's a true story. I was on the air there Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., and the Lightning's great player, Nikita Kucherov, he, Adam, whatever you're doing, stop it, please. I'll just bring him on. You can hear him in the background anyway. He's our special guest. He's our Israel correspondent all the way from Tel Aviv. Please welcome back online Mr. Adam Scott Bellows. Bellows!
Shalom, Glenn. How are you? I apologize. I was scrolling, just brushing up on the news very quickly.
Well, actually, it's my bad, bro. Here's why. Because my producer and engineer extraordinaire, Theodore Owen Pratt, who's usually spinning the dials with such aplomb, is not here today. He's got the day off. So I don't know how to meet or how to mute the damn Skype. Normally, we're yapping.
Oh, I could do that.
Well, don't worry about
it.
Don't worry about it now. But anyway, I got fired because of the Tampa Bay Lightning. And here's why. You know how when a guy is a host of a radio show and they have the news and the weather and they might kibitz a little bit, with the news guy coming out of the news. So my newsman was a guy named Tom Carco. Still his name, as a matter of fact. I used to call him the great Tom Carco because he is a great newsman. He had been sitting in the same studio for 37 freaking years. And he was a newsman's newsman, where today we basically don't have journalism anymore. Everything's everybody's opinion. Opinion and editorial are wonderful. But Tom was straight news. When I started my college career, I started at the University of Missouri in the journalism school. And the first thing you teach is you just give the facts. And Carco adhered to that. I could not pull an opinion out of this guy to save my life. So I had to figure out other ways to connect with him to be able to chit-chat. And as it turned out, Tom Carco, like myself, really loves hockey. So the night before, my Tampa Bay Lightning had won, and everybody in Wisconsin knew that I was a Lightning fan. it's one of the most important things, I think, if you're going to have a daily talk show, is you share not only your opinion and your humor and the information, and you interview people, but you share your life with your listeners, as I do with you folks. So everybody knew that I was a Lightning fan. Everybody knew that I had lived in Florida for over 20 years. Everybody knew that Dawn and I have 6 children. Everybody knew a lot of stuff. And so I commiserated or chatted with Tom about the fact that the night before, the Lightning's great player, who was the National Hockey League's leading scorer this past regular season, as the Lightning had the best record, they won the President's Trophy and tied the all-time best record of a regular season NHL team. Nikita Kucherov won the scoring title, and this particular night in, I want to say, it's 2017, he scored not only a hat trick, but what's called a natural hat trick in hockey. Do you know what a natural hat trick is, Adam?
I don't.
He's muting his Skype button, or his Skype, attaboy. Natural hat trick is when you score 3 straight goals without anybody else scoring a goal. It's a natural hat trick.
Right.
It's literally 3.
A natural hat trick, correct.
Yes. So not only did Kucherov do it, he did it from the same exact point on the ice, all in the second period. And our play-by-play man here in Tampa on the radio is a guy named Dave Mishkin, who is a very excellent play-by-play man. And he sounds normal until somebody from the Lightning scores, and then he goes completely apeshit. And it's very entertaining. And so I played for the great Tom Carco the third goal because I knew that Mishkin was going to lose his shit, and he did. It was funny. And I taught the audience, just like I've taught you beautiful humans, what a natural hat trick is. And every week I was doing a segment on race relations with a guy named Milt Thompson. And Milt was hawking a book. He was a former school superintendent from Wisconsin, and he was hawking a book one day called A Lifetime Observation on Race. Oh, that was actually the tagline or the subtitle. The title of the book was The Only One in the Room. Because as an African-American, Milt often found himself the only black guy in the room with all these educators from Wisconsin. And so he wrote a book called The Only One in the Room. And you know how we're supposed to have a discussion about race. Well, I decided to have a discussion about race. And Milt and I hit it off so well, after I interviewed him about his book the first time, I started having him in on a weekly basis. And we would talk about whatever was in the news. And Milt is actually a very conservative guy. And me, not so much. But we had a very good rapport. So I talk about the natural hat trick with the great Tom Carco. He throws it back to me, and I immediately pivot to Milt. And I said, Milt, you know, since Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in baseball, African Americans have dominated in every team sport, baseball, basketball, football. I said, why not hockey? And I knew why, but I wanted him hear him say it the way he would put it. And he just said, Glenn, it's an economic issue. Generally speaking, hockey is a very expensive sport. And generally speaking, the African-American community just has not had the dispendable income to spend when you can take a basketball, have a hoop, get a couple guys, and you got a ball game going. You got a hoop game going. And so the fact of the matter is, as the economics in our country has started to equal out, I mean, under Donald J. Trump, it's the lowest black unemployment in history. This is why his poll numbers have risen, not dramatically, but significantly among African Americans and Hispanic Americans and even Asian Americans. He's still hovering around 40%. But I swerved out of that topic, and then we continued into whatever else we were talking about. I went on vacation that day to Florida, back down here to Tampa to see my family. And when I got back the following week on a Tuesday, my boss pulled me out. He asked me if I asked Milt Thompson the question that I just told you folks. And I said, I did. He said, well, we had a complaint from another local civil rights leader, and so we're not going to be able to have you on the radio anymore. I was like, what? And I said, Dave, did you hear the clip? I have it on my computer in the office. He said, no. I said, do you want to hear the clip? He said, no, the decision's been made. And that's how I got my ass fired. From WRJN, Racine, Kenosha, Milwaukee. I still love the lighting, nonetheless. And we lost last night. We'll turn it around. I will predict. Who's your favorite hockey team, Adam? You're from Ohio. You must be a Columbus fan.
I'm not at all. Cincinnati had two, what would you call it? Triple A teams
AHL teams. AHL probably.
Yeah, they had the Cincinnati Mighty Ducks and the Cyclones. The Cyclones were really, they were just big growing up. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it was something that every kid that liked hockey knew about in Cincinnati. And it was cool that it was a minor league team. But I don't know. I never really followed professional hockey. But, I mean, like, come on. The Blackhawks, the Chicago Blackhawks, like Bobby Hull. I mean, like.
Hull. H-U-L-L. Hull.
Hull, whatever. Yeah. He was a badass.
Yeah, he was. So was his brother Dennis. So was Bobby's son Brett. He played for the St. Louis Blues, unfortunately.
Didn't they win the Stanley Cup?
The Blackhawks won. They won three Stanley Cups.
Yeah,
over about a five or six year period. Yeah, they didn't even make the playoffs. The reason I love sports and the reason that I was so thrilled to be able to run a sports oriented resident boys camp in northern Wisconsin, that is where Adam and I met. He was a camper at Camp Menominee, is because sports really transfers to so many life lessons. It's a beautiful thing. And it's not just important to learn how to compete, although it is. But you're not going to always win. The Lightning did not win last night. And, I'm sucking it up. There are people more depressed about it than I am, even though that it definitely had an impact on me. But seriously, sports teaches you how to be a gracious winner, how to learn from your losses and dust yourself off. I mean, Adam, you know how many lessons were learned as we were competing against Cahuaga.
Yeah, I mean, not even just Cahuaga, even Twilight League, specifically the softball league that we had. I mean, that was a huge part of my experience in Menominee was a huge part of building my adult psyche. I actually don't follow professional sports. Like, one of the things that I think that sunk into me at camp more than I think others was that for me, it was really about, I was one of the least athletic kids growing up. I was short, I was fat. Like, it wasn't until I became a counselor that I was of any type of athlete whatsoever. So I never got to experience what camp would have been like being a decent athlete. But, you know, for me, it was just about the ability to play and do it and compete, like you said, and to learn competition. And I don't like competition on a professional level in terms of sports. I think it's kind of, it's not what it used to be in terms of what I grew up loving. But the lessons that were taught at that camp changed and formed the adult that I am today.
Well, let me give you a proper introduction. Adam Bellows is what describes himself as a serial entrepreneur who has worked in the United States of America, China, and Eretz Yisrael. He was raised in Cincinnati. He served in the Israeli Defense Force and now calls Tel Aviv his home. You ever go to the Tel Aviv nude beaches?
No, you asked me that last time.
Well, of course.
I still haven't been.
Well, dude.
I still haven't been.
Get your shit together.
Hold on. Let me. Where are the Tel Aviv nude beaches? Never heard of them. Yeah, he keeps asking me about it. They're in France. My assistant says they're in France.
They're a little closer to you. They've got new beaches in Tel Aviv.
I don't know.
Of course they do.
On the beach line and, like, well, off of the beach line.
Adam has advised members of the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, Dov Lipman, and former Ambassador Michael Oren. Adam is the founder and CEO of the Israel Innovation Fund, a new Israel-centered NGO focused on sharing Israeli culture with the world. And now please officially welcome online Adam Scott Bellows. Hello, Adam.
Hello, Glenn.
That was like foreplay that entire time.
It was great. I loved it.
Are you ready?
It's not going to be good if there isn't good foreplay. What we like to, you know, our entire business model, we call cultural foreplay.
Why?
So, because that's what it is.
Well, yeah, but explain to the beautiful humans at it that way and how the foreplay plays out.
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's appropriate for the radio. I'm not going to lie.
Well, we're not really not on the radio. We're on the internet. And you know, I also co-host a show called Sex in the Pews.
I do know that you co-host a show called Sex in the
and,
Pews.
And anything goes on that show. Have you listened to any of the episodes?
I've listened to clips that you've posted. Yeah. I haven't listened to a full episode, but I follow the Facebook and the
thank you for the
posts, which
yeah.
are
all right. So yeah, yes, it'll be fine, Adam. It'll be fine.
What?
If you describe the foreplay that you engage in, it'll be fine.
We just listen. We're an Israel centered organization that one has a business model in terms of that is self. How do I explain this? I apologize for stumbling with my words. We have a business model that is a charity or a philanthropic fund that works to be a self-sustaining organization. So all the projects we do have to be profitable. So we create small businesses that share some element of Israeli culture and have some type of philanthropic idea behind it. We work with wine, film, art, and we throw very, very nice events where we try to combine the film and the art and the wine. So we like to say that what we do is we create the environment that stimulates all of the senses with our events that are related to Israel. And that's our cultural foreplay, so to speak.
I see.
You know, I mean, like when you want to have an amazing experience, you know, it's like sex. I mean, you want to stimulate as many senses as possible. So when we create an event that's meant to get a specific idea across, or we want to create an event specifically for a group of people or a community that's meant to instill a value or an idea or a feeling, you know, when you bring the art and the wine and maybe the film and then the environment and the venue and specifically how it's been tailored to those people, you can create a memory that, you know, would obviously you would connect to the wine, which would, you know, and the people around you, and hopefully some way people were influenced by the products that were there. Does that make sense?
Totally. It's a great strategy. I had that strategy at camp. I mean, but you know how many?
No, 100%. Listen, Glenn, it's about creating a reality. And at camp, without question, you completely and utterly create a reality because you're controlling the environment of 220 people.
I often say that I'm a reformed control freak and that the greatest profession of all the control freak professions out there, which would include teaching, government, politics, law enforcement, clergy, military, the greatest has got to be resident camp directing. Because I mean, you literally decide what day it is. But if you've got a good soul, a giving soul, like I believe I do, I know I do, and Dawn did, my partner and former wife, wonderful things can happen at a summer camp. But literally, I would wake the kids up to certain songs, and we would play certain music every day as activity calls. And I knew that those songs, like the Charlie Brown theme or Masterpiece Theater or things that were popular in the culture at the time, that when the boys would be back at home or counselors around the world they were from, the counselors, when they would hear those songs, just as one example, that would bring them right back to camp. And that's the kind of atmosphere it sounds like you're creating on a temporary basis at these events for the Israel Innovation Fund.
I would completely agree with everything that you said, and there are so many songs that bring me back to camp immediately. I can't hear the Full House theme song without thinking about camp.
What was the first song, and probably to this day, Jason Felgraber, the current owner of Camp Menominee Eagle River, what was the first song we would start every session with? And I know that Steve Konevsky continued the tradition. Do you remember Adam Scott Bellows?
I do not, but I know when you say it, I'm going to remember it.
Little darling, it's been a long and lonely winter. Right? Here comes the sun.
Here comes the sun.
Yep. Yeah, every freaking summer.
I believe you would also end every session with it.
No. I would end the session. I don't know what Steve did, and I don't know what Jason does, if anything. But I would end the session with Willie Nelson's Stay a Little Longer.
Yeah, leaving camp was a tough day.
It was traumatic.
It wasn't that it was traumatic. It's that you go from being at home to a completely different environment for if you were an eight-week camper for 8 weeks. And it's just it goes very quickly, like from beginning to end, especially when you are there for a shorter period of time. It's just, you know, it's been a yeah, it was a great time.
It goes like this. Stay all night, stay a little longer. Dance all night, dance a little longer. Going in the corner.
I miss campfires and the relay more than anything else.
And the sounds of the fire crackling and the smells of the North Woods and the smell that you get after a rain.
Your son and I, Glenn, built one of the most badass fires.
You did.
That green and white history ever saw.
Yeah.
And it was captured. We still have a picture of it. Do you know what I'm saying?
I was there, and it was an unconventionally built fire.
Mm-hmm.
But Jacob Ronald Olson Klein is who Adam Scott Bellows is referring to. Yes, they were co-captains of the mighty, what year team was it, 20 what, 19?
2002
mighty green team at Camp Menominee. Big green and white color war, very great camp tradition. And you have to boil a can of water in a rolling boil as one of the events of the all-camp relay. And so, yes, it's a big deal because if that fire goes wrong, you're screwed, basically. So how else has camp informed you, Adam, not only what you're doing now with the Israel Innovation Fund, but with your decision to make Aliyah, with your decision to move to Israel, with your decision to join the Israeli Defense Force? How did camp prepare you for that kind of massive cultural shift?
Okay, at least for the IDF, I mean, like, it was just like camp. I mean, like, you know, there was a lot to, you know, you're with a bunch of people, you're hiking, you're living in a tight space. I mean, it's just the environment was similar in terms of the way you would socialize with people. But I didn't really there wasn't a lot that I thought about in connection with camp when I was in the Army. I mean, other than maybe the social aspect of it. We had Israeli counselors at camp for a couple of years, but by the time I got older, for some reason that had stopped. But, I got used to being in the woods, I guess, at an early age. I mean, but I don't think that's very different for people in this country. I mean, nature is a pretty big thing.
Do women fight in combat? Because I know the Israeli women do fight in combat there. How does that work?
What do you mean? How does it work?
Well, I mean, are they limited in their roles? Can they do anything that a man would do in combat for the Israeli Defense Force?
I know that there are women in the undercover terrorist group. I mean, you've seen Fauda, you know. I mean, look at Fauda.
I don't know what Fauda is.
Fauda, the television show on Netflix,
I've never seen
Fauda.
I didn't even know about it.
Oh, come, Glenn, what are you? Oh, my God, Glenn, you're like, you're missing out.
I'm too busy watching Lightning games to watch Fauda.
I'm telling
Fauda.
You right now, listen, you got to watch Fauda. You're going to love it.
How do you spell it? How do you spell Fauda?
Fauda.
F as in Frank?
F as in Frank.
Auda. What does Fauda mean?
I believe it means chaos.
Really?
It
means when a military mission erupts.
Who's talking in the background?
My assistant Samantha, who forgot to message you.
Bring Samantha over to the Skype machine.
Really?
Samantha, yes, he's asking you to come over and say a few words.
You there, Samantha?
Am I gonna be?
She went to Penn.
Am I gonna be famous?
Aren't you already famous as Adam Bellis's assistant?
Yeah, I guess so.
Get a little closer to the device, and
okay.
And you went to Penn.
Correct.
What did you study?
Communications and art history.
Well, you're right in there with you were well prepared for what you guys are doing in the land. Are you Jewish?
Yes, I am.
Are you? Did you make?
100%.
Did you make Aliyah?
My dad is Israeli, so technically I was born Israeli. So. I've been living here for 9 months, but I haven't like officially made Aliyah.
How well do you speak Hebrew?
Pretty well.
All right. I want you to say in Hebrew, I want you to say that Adam Scott Bellows is the most handsome, smartest entrepreneur in the land of Israel.
Adam Scott Bellows, who have bachor hachi chatich v'chacham v'naim v'nechman b'chol Eretz Yisrael.
And then say, I am a very good liar. Thanks, Sam.
You're welcome.
Shalom, everybody. There she is, Samantha.
He only calls me Samantha when I'm in trouble.
Is she in trouble, Adam, right now?
No, she's absolutely not in trouble.
Well, she should be in trouble because she didn't get back to me to make the appointment for today's quality podcast.
Can I tell you something, though?
I think you have the ability to do that. Go ahead.
Can I tell you something? Yes. I will give her credit where credit's due. You're her first, like, actual, like, oops in, like, a long time.
How long?
Like, with the scheduling thing. Yeah, I don't think she just knew. I didn't think she realized it was as immediate as it was.
How long have you guys been working together? She said she's been there for 9 months.
Since 9 months.
Right on.
Well, how long were you here before?
Wait,
it's already the fourth month in this year. Right, and you started working for me in July.
It really doesn't make a difference.
When?
Did Sam?
Sorry, I apologize.
Did Sam serve the IDF?
No, she just moved here.
And does she have to eventually?
I don't believe so because she's a woman over the age of a certain age.
Mm-hmm. All right, that's good. She timed it well. That works out.
I don't think it was about not being in the IDF. I just think like she came to the point in her life like later that she wanted to be here.
We had Adam Scott Bellows on in one of the early.
It was a great episode. I really enjoyed it.
It really was. You can go back and check it out at glennkleinonline.com. But a lot has happened in Israel
and
vis-a-vis Jewish relations in this country with the new Congress that came in at the beginning of the year. A lot of what many people, including your friendly neighborhood podcast host, believes are anti-Semitic attitudes by some of the new members of the United States Congress.
Can I ask you, do you follow my rantings on Facebook about the axis of evil in Congress?
The answer to your yes or no question is no.
Oh,
because
okay.
I'm too busy on Tampa Bay Lightning fan page sites.
I apologize for interrupting you.
Stop apologizing. What is the axis of evil?
No, I don't really think they're the axis of evil. I just I think that they have an opinion that is different from mine dramatically. That's all.
Who do you refer to?
AOC, Ilhan Omar, and what's her name from Detroit, Talib. Like they're just, you know, in terms of how they view the country that I love and the people that I'm a part of, I think they one misrepresent my view, the way they represent my view. I think they misrepresent it. And I also feel that they don't want to see a peaceful solution. Actually, like I don't think they ever want to see a solution with Israel in the picture. And I think that there's a certain rhetoric and a certain ideology that goes with not wanting to see Israel in the picture that they can't really hide.
Did you hear what Representative Omar said just the other day about 9/11?
I didn't, and I know she made a comment, but I mean, like, it's an issue. It's a very dangerous, I mean, like.
Here's what she said, Adam. In referencing the terrorist attack that happened on September 11th, 2001, this representative from Minneapolis, who is Muslim and wears the hijab. So thank you. Not that that's means anything, but I'm just pointing it out that when you see her, you'll know who I'm referring to. She, in referencing 9/11, she said, and some people did some things. That's how she described the attacks.
Yeah, no, 9/11. I mean, like, but that's,
some people did some
that's
things.
That's like what it is. Now, listen, I reshared something or I read something on Facebook. I can't confirm it like 100%, but it said like she was lobbying for somebody with Muslim Brotherhood ties to be freed or something like that. I mean, it's just whatever. Like, there's just something I don't. They're not my cup of tea. Like, well, I think that their constituents, and I've spoken with some of their constituents from Minnesota here in Israel, who voted for her. They feel very betrayed because they did not get who they voted for. They got somebody completely differently, somebody completely different.
I maintain that the anti-Zionist, the anti-Israel rhetoric is nothing more than good old-fashioned anti-Semitism warmed over.
We've discussed this. That's not the problem. But it's different anti-Semitism because their anti-Semitism comes from an idea that held them back for 100 years. And it destroyed this region. It's the reason why the Arab countries are... We've actually discussed this on your old show. I think, like, we've gone into it a little bit.
Yeah, but
I mean,
this is the new show, Adam. You don't have to do that.
Yeah, talk. It's absolutely ridiculous. The idea of anti-Zionism completely held back the Arab world 100 years, and it destroyed their economies and empowered their dictators. It kept capitalism from entering. Look at Syria. It's absolutely ridiculous to think that the state of Israel will not exist. And instead of that, Palestinians, it will just like be there, or there will be some type of conflict resolution without the state of Israel existing. Like there's nothing wrong with the idea of a global society, okay? But you need lines to govern and protect people. You can't just be governing everywhere. It's not possible. There's a reason why there are boundaries and lines and neighbors and homes and families, you know, I mean, like, it's the breakdown of civilization and society. It's just the idea of anti-Zionism corrupted this region for so long, and it's horrible. Look how much money was spent in the last century on wars with Israel, and look at the result in the surrounding countries.
Israel just keeps getting stronger and stronger and stronger from it because they have to innovate. They have to survive. The survival instinct is so strong in the human psyche. Let me tell you something. The Arabs are not concerned. If they would leave Israel alone, there's not an Arab country that surrounds Israel that would be worried about Israel attacking them ever.
I mean, listen. I know we spoke yesterday a little bit about doing a show to talk about the. We can talk about it. All the Arab world wasn't surprised that Netanyahu got elected, and he's in the middle of brokering. Look, we have peace with our neighbors, it seems like, almost. It's cold right now, and it's not official yet, but I mean, we are obviously, you know, in a completely different era than we were, and the thing is that ideology is from a different era, and it's the old world, and all of these young people keep talking about not doing things the way, like, the last generation did them, and this is a remnant ideology that failed, and it's about losing.
Right, but the madrasas and the fundamentalist Muslims are not going to give up this philosophy. They're training their kids in these countries and places, still like Saudi Arabia.
But the big thing it's about eradicating the radicals because there are so many moderates.
But they're not going to be eradicated until. Just like Nazism wasn't eradicated, just like Imperial Japanese philosophical underpinnings was not eradicated until something dramatic happened. And I think it's coming. Something dramatic is going to happen. I think that it may be in our lifetime. I have no idea, obviously. But I think they're going to get a hold of a dirty bomb, and they're going to drop it in D.C. or in New York or in Tel Aviv somewhere. And it's going to be
God forbid.
Yes, but it's going to be a nightmare. Well, God didn't forbid 9/11. He didn't forbid the Holocaust. I think.
Yeah, but a dirty bomb that could destroy. I mean, like.
Yeah, no. There'll be 100,000 people that will die, and just like the Holocaust, shocked the world, and they paused momentarily. It was like a pause button that was hit on the historic anti-Semitism that has reigned the earth for thousands of years and continues to this day. But the world paused for a brief second. Even the world body could not deal with the images of the Holocaust. And Israel was established. The United States was the first country to recognize Israel. That was when Harry Truman was president. Then here came, believe it or not, beautiful humans, the Soviet Union. And Israel was established. They partitioned Palestine into two countries, an Arab state and a Jewish state. The Jewish state became known as Israel. The Arab state became known as Jordan. There were no Palestinians. People weren't called Palestinians back in the day. Most people have no idea about this. The Palestinian Liberation Organization didn't start until Israel won the war.
Wait a minute. People.
What? Adam? Oh. All right. We got issues. Where's Owen when I need him? On his day off at the beach or somewhere. Let's see if we can do this again. I can't even vamp. Good radio, isn't it? Oh, here we go.
Hello.
I feel like you were about to correct my a historical. What were you about to say? You were saying I said there wasn't an organized, people were not known as Palestinians.
No,
known as Arabs at the time.
Okay. Listen, the term Palestinian was used for both Jew and Arab and Christian. Okay, because it was the British mandate of Palestine. It was the first time that there was any type of border or area.
Right,
like that was
but
actually
right, but what I'm saying,
you know what I'm saying?
Yes,
like,
but it is a historically accurate statement that the whole concept was 60% of Palestine was going to the Arabs, 40% was going to the Jews, and if Israel would not have been attacked as soon as they declared independence on what was May 14th, 1948, correct?
Mm-hmm.
If the Arabs would have just said, "All right." Yes, of course, in any kind of massive change like this, people were uprooted, and it sucks. But nobody is suggesting, for example, that the United States today should not exist because we screwed over the Native Americans.
I mean, I would definitely say there are many people that argue that probably, but it's just because there are people out there, but
they wouldn't get elected to Congress if they said it.
No, listen. All I'm going to say is that there are a lot of reasons. There are a lot of nuances to this conflict as to why it happened and how the Palestinian identity that we know today is the identity of people who refer to themselves as Palestinians exists.
But the fact of the matter is, though, that Israel has bent over backwards. I have a friend who was from Ramallah. He had a pita joint here in town. And we were talking about this. And, of course, you know, it's like, well, you can't the Israeli lobby won't allow people, the American people or the American representatives to criticize Israel. That's bullshit. There's nobody more critical of what goes on in Israel than the Israelis. I mean, all you got to do is follow a little bit of Israeli press. I mean, I saw a thing that said that because...
Let me finish. Oh, sorry.
Bibi Netanyahu winning, I saw on one of the Israeli news feeds, said, we have to admit now that Israel has become a dictatorship because Netanyahu won a record fifth term. I mean, come on, a dictatorship?
Wait a minute.
Go ahead.
I got to tell you, do you know how ridiculous that is? Because he's had like one full term the entire time. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's been new government after new government after new government because of coalition building.
But this guy's argument was not that he had a fifth term. I'm just stating that as a fact. His argument was that Netanyahu took such extreme measures to assure his victory that it was like a dictator state. And Why did Netanyahu, and this just happened a couple of days ago, why did Bibi win again?
He won again because the opposition, okay, listen, this country for years, social issues didn't matter so much when it came to the election. Security was the big thing, you know, and there was a big changeover for the labor, you know, labor was the dominant party of early Israel until the Yom Kippur War. The Yom Kippur War is when this country completely changed, and after that, Yitzhak Rabin became president, prime minister. Then he had to resign, and then Menachem Begin ran in the elections with Likud. Like, they consolidated all the right-wing parties. They formed the Likud, and Begin became prime minister. And there was like a capitalism was brought to the country a little bit. I mean, it was just a totally different campaign about the socioeconomic background, but also the security situation.
Are you on your headset? Are you on your headset now?
No. I'm on the speakerphone. I'll just talk closer.
I know we're just having problems that we were having earlier.
For the last three elections, the social issues going on in the country have been a major topic of discussion because it's clear that the security situation is handled in many respects. The reason why I think Netanyahu went to the lengths that he went to secure this election is because we're in the middle of he's been working on the peace plan. And I mean, like, and they're going to form a unity government if the peace plan is real. I'm very, I really, really hoped that in a fairy tale Disney world of what Israel could be, that there would be a unity government with him and the opposition, blue and white party. But obviously, it's just not possible because that would be really what's best for the country. But the problem is that everybody's just trying to take his job all the time, and it's not about doing what's best for the country. It's about, you know, getting Netanyahu out and not letting him gracefully leave. That's a big thing too. You know, it was a stunning victory though. I mean, like he pulled it off. It's fascinating. His there are a ton of parties that didn't cross the threshold in the parliamentary system here. You have to be able to get about 3.24 seats worth of votes and a number of different right-wing parties that they thought were going to upset the coalition building in Netanyahu's favor didn't make it because right. Netanyahu got more votes than anyone ever thought. It was the largest under his leadership.
You know, obviously we just came through an entire investigation. The Mueller report is going to be released where it was alleged that not only did the Trump campaign collude with Vladimir Putin and the Russians, but that the Russians were involved in trying to influence the election. And we have some pretty good proof on that, obviously. Apparently not so much on the Trump campaign and the Trump organization colluding with the Russians. But this country has been meddling in foreign elections forever. And we know that the Obama administration tried to influence and try to get Netanyahu to lose. This time, though, Trump was on the ballot in Israel as well. What do you think it says about Israel and about President Trump that the fact that Netanyahu did win such a pretty decisive victory, as it turns out?
The only thing that I think it says is that not everybody understands what's going on right now, and it's because so many different things are going on. But I really think we're just in a very good time for peace. I think that it means that there is the ability to create economic prosperity in the countries around Israel, and that's what I think everyone in this country hopes for and prays for. I think that if we can get this prime minister through a full term without, you know, or at least let him get this peace plan moving, I think something very good could happen. I'm very happy. I do really wish that the ultra-Orthodox were out of the government. I've always felt that way, and I hate that they're involved in the government, but it is what it is.
Well, whether it be Netanyahu or Menachem Begin or Ariel Sharon, these very right-wing prime ministers have all attempted or have actually made peace with Israel's Arab neighbors. They were the most successful at doing it to the degree it's been done. And it's kind of like when Richard Nixon went to China, the great anti-communist warrior, and had not only established diplomatic relations with China, but also had détente with the Soviet Union. I mean, it's like the conservative population in Israel would obviously trust a Netanyahu to make a deal than a guy like Ehud Barak or whoever, yeah.
Yeah, no, but I mean, listen, it's so clear what's going on right now, and Netanyahu has been in office since the start of the instability around the region, since the Arab Spring. So, I think everything's just kind of coming to a close now. I think it's going to take about 4 or 5 years for the Middle East to get cleaned up. Saudi Arabia is you know, it's completely changing. I think as long as they can tame Iran, and I think that's a huge
thank God for Iran, because the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So, I mean, they hate the Iranian, well, not the Iranians, but they hate the Iranian government. And so this is why Israel's getting so much more cooperation from places like Saudi Arabia and many other Arab countries. But you mentioned, Adam, the social issues in Israel that we never hear about in this country. What are these social issues that you're referring to that really need to be addressed now, as you say? Now, by the way, Netanyahu was the one that built the wall to separate the West Bank from Israel proper, and that's when all the suicide bombings stopped. And so, listen, walls work. And walls, it's one thing to have a wall to keep people in. It's another thing to have a wall to keep people out. And after they built that wall and the separation, where, as you say, a lot of the violence and the contention has been built around, no more suicide bombers, pretty much. That was a regular occurrence before you made Aliyah in Israel. It doesn't happen anymore. But what are the social issues that you refer to that Israel needs to grapple with right now?
Oh, I mean, I would say it's the there's a wage gap that's quite large right now. It's very hard to afford apartments here. The ultra-Orthodox being involved in the government is a big thing. What the education of children and how the future education policies are being written. The fact that a kid that wakes up in the South doesn't have the same opportunity as the kid that wakes up in the center. I mean, the country is divided right now because it's not a religion. How do I explain this? The biggest thing is taking the ultra-Orthodox out of the government. I mean, like, it's just a huge thing. The Israelis don't want religion as a part of their government. They believe in the separation of church and state. Do you know what I'm saying? Even the modern Orthodox, like, national religious, you know, people who live in the West Bank, like, they don't want, you know, a government that is going to be forcing, you know, and indoctrinating people, or especially in extreme form, if that makes sense.
One thing that a lot of people around the planet and that are listening to us right now may not realize is Israel is not a religious place. There are religious, obviously, holy sites to the three major religions of the world. There is a percentage of Orthodox and extreme Orthodox Jewish people. It's about 10%. 90% of Jews in Israel are secular. They may have some form of observation or observance. They take the holidays off. I mean, there's a holiday in Israel every damn week, pretty much. But and people enjoy themselves during those holidays, whether they're related to religion or not. But Israel's not Israel is one of the first countries with gay rights. There's a huge gay rights pride parade in Tel Aviv every year.
Every year.
Gay people can serve openly in the military in Israel. Israel is a very progressive. So my friend from Ramallah, who had the pita shop, we were talking about this, and he came over to this country, but he still has family in Ramallah. And he said, Glenn, he said, you can't ever tell anybody who told you this, but I am telling you, because he said my family in Ramallah would be killed. He said we never had it better than when the Israelis were in charge of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And that came from a Palestinian, ladies and gentlemen. He lived there. I've been there three times. This whole notion that Israel is an apartheid state is really effed up. Arabs have rights in Israel, way more rights than Jewish people have in Arab countries. Now, is there persecution? Is there prejudice? Is there racism? Absolutely. Just like every country on the blooming planet. I mean, a lot of people don't know that Arabs serve in the parliament there, Adam.
Yeah, and they just lost a significant amount of representation because they couldn't get their act together and form a joint party.
So what? So you're. It sounds like you're actually pretty optimistic about the future. Obviously, you've got
very optimistic about the future. I don't think there's going to be a dirty bomb somewhere in some city that explodes and 100,000 people get killed. Like, God forbid. Like, I really think, like, the fight, the people who, how do I explain this? The people who happen to be holding office in a lot of the world, in very top countries that are strong, are fighting extremism, like ideological extremism, in terms of radical Islam, very well right now, in my opinion. And I think that's very important for the stability of the global structure.
I don't know if that I finished my thought on the whole concept of that would be the dramatic event like the Holocaust, the establishment of Israel, followed that. But if that something like that would happen, and obviously nobody wants that except for the knuckleheads out there who would like to drop a dirty bomb on a major U.S. or European or Israeli city, I think that type of event could be akin to the Holocaust as far as world history, where even the governments that allow this radical Islam to not only exist but to prosper, that might be the thing that says, all right, enough's enough. Because we could never take out enough radical Islamic leaders to change that dynamic. I really do believe that Islam is going to go the way that Judaism went and Christianity went, which is to my modern times, to modernity. And they will enter the civilized nations of the world. I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime, maybe in Adam's lifetime, who's a young whippersnapper, serial entrepreneur in Tel Aviv. But it might happen by Judah Klein's son, Connor Klein, my first grandson's life. That would be good. I'd be good with that.
I mean, I hope so.
Okay. All right, Adam, well, get on with your day. You sound pretty busy over there. So
no, all like at five, in about 2 minutes, I have an appointment coming.
I accurately diagnosed the situation.
We let me tell you what we're doing, though. As you know, the Israel Innovation Fund has an art project, and one of the things was we had an artist in residence for 6 months who made a significant amount of work. His name is Salomon Souza. He's well known for having transformed a neighborhood in Jerusalem called Machne Yehuda by basically doing street art on every storefront in the neighborhood. And it turned the open market into a, like, very, how do I explain it? It gave life to a place that was beginning a renaissance, if that makes sense.
What's the Israel Innovation Fund website if people want to check you out?
It's TIIF.org. Some of his art is actually up there for sale in prints. And so one of the things we're doing is we're recurating the office right now with some of our photographs from the photographer that works for us, Aviram Waldman, who's an amazing war photographer, some of Solomon's art, some of my own collection. And we're just, you know, this is where we host people for wine tastings and events, and we're just mixing it up a little bit.
All right. Well, thank you for coming online. Tell Sam I'm no longer mad at her, that I forgive her. And
she can hear you.
And we will talk to you soon from the land, okay?
I miss you, man. I hope I get to see you soon. When you talk to Jake, will you tell him I say hello?
Well, yes, I will, but there's Facebook and shit, dude.
We interact. Don't worry.
All right. All right. Love you. So, there he goes.
Yeah, likewise, my brother.
Bye. There he goes. Adam Scott Bellows from the land of Israel. Yeah, I mean, to compare Israel to South Africa is absurd. And they lose a lot of support because the people that would like to see a Palestine, I would like to see a Palestine at this point. It's enough already. When Bill Clinton, at the end of his term, he had Ehud Barak, who was the prime minister of Israel at the time, and the knucklehead Yasser Arafat to Camp David to try to do this. And the Israelis gave 97% of what Arafat wanted, including half of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem. Why couldn't there be two Jerusalems? There's two Kansas cities. There's a Kansas City, Missouri, and there's a Kansas City, Kansas, right across the border. What would be the big deal if Jerusalem was Jerusalem, Israel, and Jerusalem, Palestine? Really? And they gave them that 97% of what Arafat wanted, and he couldn't pull the trigger on peace. Not the way President Sadat did of Egypt. It cost Sadat his life. He was assassinated when Sadat made peace at Camp David with Jimmy Carter and Menachem Begin. Arafat couldn't do it. He spent the rest of his day just, well, he always moved night to night. But literally, he was just, he ended up being in a headquarters, I want to say, in Ramallah, they had no power. The Israelis had shut the power off. And he died. And then eventually you get Hamas in Gaza allowing and lobbing rockets to places near where Adam lives, especially in the north of the country. Israelis will not stand for that. And the world condemns Israel as Hamas stores their rockets in hospitals and schools where children play. Never being condemned by the United Nations for that. What a joke. So as critical as I am of President Donald J. Trump, my popper's not popping so good today. So well. Donald J. Trump. Here we go. I mean, Trump is really not well. But he's been solid about Israel. Barack Hussein Obama, not so much. Obama allowed Syria to become what Syria has become. He drew the red line in the sand. It's a red line if they use chemical weapons and did nothing about it. And here we are. Russia was not in the Middle East since they had left Afghanistan. They're back now. I voted for Barack Obama the first time because I knew that John McCain was going to be no different than anything we had. And as a libertarian, as a rational, logical thinker, to do the same things over and over again and expect different results is insane. So I knew McCain would be the same. And I believed the man from Chicago that we're not the red states, we're not the blue states, we are the United States of America, of America. And he was just a Chicago politician. Say anything, do anything. He's a Mayor Daley-style politician. Nice guy, apparently. Beautiful wife. Lovely daughters. Looks good even in mom jeans. But he was an awful president. Here's how bad a President Barack Obama was. We got Donald Trump out of the deal. Obama and the Democrats and the Republicans, the leadership and the presidential candidates were so bad over time that people were willing to vote for Donald J. Trump. See, I could say Donald J. Trump anytime I want. My old boss at the radio station told me that after he won the presidency, he didn't want me to pop my peas. See, I stole that bit from Rush Limbaugh because whenever he would talk about Jesse Jackson back in the day, he would go, "The Reverend Jackson." It's shtick. But I couldn't do it at the radio. I can do anything I goddamn well please right now. I knew, as upset as I was when they fired me at that radio station, I knew there would be one day I would be happy that they did. because I could get back down to Florida. My grandson's here. I have family, friends, the weather, and my Tampa Bay Lightning will come back, I'm predicting right now. And I'm predicting we will do another Glenn Klein online in the very near future, so stay logged on for that. I've got a program planned for you parents out there, especially you either young grandparents who could share it with your children or young parents about some parenting strategies that I learned as a camp director, which dovetailed perfectly into my parenting experience. As you may or may not know, Dawn and I have 6 children, all grown now, and now the C-man, numero uno, the first Klein grandchild, is doing amazing, really traumatic birth, and he has come into his own. Got a clean bill of health from the doctor yesterday. Has been going to physical therapy, and he was on medication. It was an awful, awful delivery. And my daughter-in-law, Candace, was a trooper. Her husband, my son, Judah, has really stepped up. And Connor is doing incredible, I'm happy to report. So we will do it all again next time. And please tell your friends about GlennKleinOnline.com. And check out the other podcast, Sex in the Pews, if you dare. We describe it as we celebrate sexuality and we expose religion. And it is not for the faint of heart or for people that don't like strong language and sexual content and hilarity or have a problem with condemning historic, ancient, awful religion. So I want to thank you for joining us. You can contact me at coach@glennkleinonline.com if there's something I can help you. I really do specialize in relational issues between men and women. You can read all about it at my website, coachglennkline.com. Owen, I'm hoping you are having a wonderful day off and giving a great day as well. And until next time, this is Glenn Klein Online saying, go Lightning and shalom, everybody.